Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app.
Glad to be here for another one.
So, I want you to imagine a thought experiment. Imagine having the technology to just, you know, rewrite the genetic code of an entire wild population.
Right, playing with the fundamental software of an ecosystem.
Exactly. And the objective is monumental, right? Like eradicating a devastating disease that kills hundreds of thousands of people annually.
Yeah, which is a very real, very pressing goal.
And we actually have the molecular tools to force that genetic change through a population. But the real friction point here is what happens when you take that highly engineered creature and put it in a cage for 2 full years.
Does the genetic software update actually hold, or does nature just find a way to break it?
Right. Because evolution is relentless.
It is. And honestly, this is the defining biological question for this kind of technology. I mean, scientists have theorized about this clash between engineered genetics and natural selection for years.
There's been a lot of math, right? Lots of models.
Oh, endless mathematical models and, there. You know, short-term laboratory tests. But today we're looking at long-term empirical evidence.
Which is so rare.
Extremely rare. We finally have data on what happens when a targeted genetic modification goes, you know, head-to-head with the chaotic engine of evolution over dozens of generations.
It's just wild. So today we celebrate the work of the teams at the University of California, Irvine, and the Johns Hopkins University Malaria Research Institute, who have advanced our understanding of CRISPR-based gene drives.
Yeah, and we really have to highlight why those institutions matter here. They are doing something genuinely monumental.
Bridging that translational gap, right?
Exactly, because it's one thing to demonstrate the theoretical mechanics of a gene drive in a petri dish. That's, you know, relatively straightforward now.
Sure, the basic CRISPR mechanics.
Right, but it is entirely different to prove that those mechanics remain robust enough over years to actually function as a real-world public health application.
Okay, let's unpack this a bit for everyone listening, because to really grasp the weight of this, you have to look at the massive failure of our current tools.
Yeah, unfortunately, the status quo is not holding up.
We are talking about malaria here.
Yeah.
Caused by the Plasmodium parasite and transmitted by Anopheles mosquitoes.
Which is just a devastating global health crisis.
It really is. And for decades, our frontline defenses have basically been insecticides to kill the mosquitoes, and drugs to clear the parasite from humans.
Both of which are failing rapidly, by the way, due to rising biological resistance.
Exactly. Nature always pushes back. So that brings us to this concept of population modification via gene drives.
Right, a totally different approach.
And, you know, if you picture standard Mendelian genetics, inheritance is basically a coin toss, right?
Yeah, 50-50 chance.
An offspring has a 50% chance of inheriting a specific gene from a parent. But a gene drive essentially rigs that biological casino.
That's a great way to put it. It forces the odds.
It uses CRISPR to aggressively copy and paste itself into the opposite chromosome. So instead of half the offspring getting the gene, nearly 100% inherit it. Yeah. It's like a viral social media trend that forces the algorithm to show it to everyone.
Yes, exactly. And the mechanism relies on a process called homology-directed repair.
Okay, how does that work?
Well, when the CRISPR system, specifically the Cas9 enzyme, cuts the target chromosome, the cell kind of panics. It urgently tries to repair the break.
It thinks there's genetic damage.
Right, and the gene drive is designed to trick the cell into using the engineered DNA as the repair template.
Oh, that's sneaky.
Very. Yeah. So the cell ends up copying the entire drive, including whatever payload we've attached to it, straight into the broken chromosome.
Meaning you go from a mosquito with one copy to a mosquito with two copies.
Exactly. You go from heterozygous to homozygous. The ultimate goal is to rapidly sweep a desired trait through a wild population in a fraction of the time natural selection would normally dictate.
But rigging the casino like that to force a trait into a wild population, I mean, that carries immense ecological weight.
It's massive. You can't just release something like that lightly.
Right. You wouldn't just release it on a hunch. But how do we know it's safe and effective? There has to be some kind of standard it meets before it leaves the lab.
There absolutely is. It's called the Target Product Profile, or the TPP.
The TPP? Okay, what's on that checklist?
Think of it as the ultimate operational checklist a gene drive must complete to even be considered by global health authorities. First, it requires a transmission efficiency of over 90%.
So it has to spread incredibly well.
Yes. Second, it requires minimal fitness cost to the mosquito.
Meaning what exactly?
Meaning the genetic load we add can't make the mosquito so you know, metabolically weak that they just die out or fail to mate.
Sure.
If they can't compete, the drive stops.
Okay. That makes sense. What else?
It demands extremely low resistance rates. And crucially, it requires that the specific effector genes we attach, the actual payload designed to block the malaria parasite, function flawlessly.
Right, because if the mosquito is genetically rendered incapable of carrying the parasite, the transmission cycle to humans is finally broken.
Exactly. The effector genes are the whole point of the exercise.
So the standard is set. Now, to prove this system actually works, the researchers didn't just run a quick proof of concept.
No, they went all in. The scale is incredible.
They set up massive cage trials that ran continuously for 2 full years. 2 years. They tracked 35 discrete, non-overlapping generations of mosquitoes.
Which is just an absolute marathon in laboratory terms.
And the physical reality of this is staggering. They used 3 specific modified strains for this. 2 were in the species Anopheles calutzii.
Right, those were designated ACTP-13 and ACTP-43.
And 1 was in Anopheles gambia, designated HETP-13. Across this study, they tracked precisely 1,873,420 mosquitoes.
Almost 2 million insects.
But wait, how on earth do you track a genetic edit across nearly 1.9 million mosquitoes? You can't possibly sequence the DNA of every single one.
No, that would be financially and logistically impossible. The shortcut they used is actually brilliant.
I'm guessing it's not molecular sequencing for all of them?
Definitely not. It relies on visual biological markers, which they deeply integrated right into the CRISPR design.
Visual markers?
Yeah. The researchers built a Cas9 and guide RNA cassette designed to sever a very specific location, the mosquito's cardinal gene.
Okay, the cardinal gene. What does that do in a normal mosquito?
In a wild-type mosquito, the cardinal gene regulates a biochemical pathway that gives them their normal black eye color.
Oh, interesting.
Right. So the gene drive interrupts that exact gene and inserts the engineered payload, but alongside a fluorescent protein marker.
Wait, so they glow?
Literally, yes. If the mosquito successfully inherits the drive, its eyes literally glow blue under a specific wavelength of light, thanks to a cyan fluorescent protein.
That is wild.
And in one of the strains, they used an M-cherry protein that made the entire body of the mosquito glow red.
So you essentially turn the genetic edit into a visible beacon. A technician can just look under a microscope and instantly separate the wild-type mosquitoes from the transgenic ones.
Just by looking at their eye color, it completely eliminates the need for constant, expensive molecular sequencing just to track the spread.
But obviously, the glowing eyes are just the packaging, right? The actual cargo inside that gene drive is the anti-malaria payload.
Yes, the glowing eyes just let us know the cargo was delivered.
And this payload isn't just a single barrier. It's like a multi-layered molecular armory. They pack the drive with genes that produce single-chain antibodies, specifically M1C3 and M2A10.
The precision of those antibodies is really fascinating.
How do they actually fight the parasite?
So when the mosquito takes a blood meal from an infected human, the Plasmodium parasite enters the mosquito's midgut.
Right.
The M1C3 and M2A10 antibodies are engineered to bind perfectly to surface proteins on the parasite, but at different stages of its life cycle.
Like a 1-2 punch.
Exactly. They basically neutralize the parasite, preventing it from crossing the midgut wall or ever entering the salivary glands.
And for the TP43 strain, the researchers went even further, right?
They did. They added a multi-effector cassette loaded with antimicrobial peptides like melanin and scorpion.
Scorpion sounds intense.
It is. These peptides operate differently than the antibodies. They physically compromise the cellular membrane of the parasite. They just shred it.
Wow. But producing all of those antibodies and peptides requires metabolic energy. I mean, if a mosquito is constantly synthesizing scorpion and melanin, it's going to be exhausted.
Right. And if it's exhausted, it will be outcompeted by wild mosquitoes for mates and resources.
Which violates that target product profile requirement for minimal fitness cost you mentioned earlier.
Exactly. To solve that, they used blood meal inducible promoters.
Okay, so the weapons aren't always turned on.
Right. It's a highly elegant energy conservation strategy. Huh. The engineered genes just sit dormant in the mosquito's DNA.
Until they bite someone.
Yes. They are chemically triggered to activate only when the mosquito digests a blood meal, which is precisely the moment the malaria parasite would be entering the system anyway.
That's incredibly efficient. The mosquito only expends the metabolic energy to produce the weapons when the threat is actively present.
Exactly.
So we have a highly efficient copying mechanism, a visible tracking system, and an energy efficient multi-layered defense payload.
Mm.
The setup is just incredibly sophisticated.
It really represents the cutting edge of this field.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Because the true test is whether that genetic architecture actually held together over 35 generations of relentless breeding.
Right. Does it break down?
For the Anopheles colutzi cages, the ATP P13 and ATP P43 strains, the results were just absolute. They hit 100% drive introduction by generation 3.
Which is incredibly fast.
Every single mosquito in those cages became homozygous, carrying 2 copies of the drive, and remained locked at 100% for the entire 2-year duration.
No breakdown at all.
None. But biology is rarely that neat across the board. The Anopheles gambier strain, AGTP13, they kind of hit a wall, didn't they?
They did, and this is the plot twist. They ran 3 identical cage trials for the AGTP13 strain, labeled A1, A2, and A3.
Okay, and how did they do?
Well, cages A1 and A2 mirrored the previous success. They reached full introduction and held perfectly stable, but cage A3 demonstrated exactly how evolution fights back.
What happened in A3?
The drive in cage A3 reached about 98% introduction around generation 7, which looks great. But then the wild type trait started making a comeback.
Wait, really?
Yeah, they eventually started driving the engineered mosquitoes down.
But if the CRISPR mechanism is designed to force its own inheritance, the wild type mosquitoes in cage A3 must have developed like a specific molecular defense against the Cas9 enzyme.
Yes, exactly.
It had to change the locks on the target gene so the CRISPR scissors couldn't even recognize the cut site.
That is precisely what happened. Because Cas9 relies on a guide RNA to find an exact genetic sequence, it needs a perfect geometric match to bind and cut.
So it missed the target.
In cage A3, the researchers isolated a tiny mutation at the target site, a highly specific 3 base pair insertion.
Just 3 base pairs.
Just 3. But that insertion altered the spatial geometry of the DNA just enough that the Cas9 enzyme was completely blind to it. It couldn't bind and it couldn't cut.
What's fascinating here is that mutations happen constantly in wild populations. Most of them are detrimental or neutral.
Right, mostly background noise.
But for this specific 3 base pair insertion to take over the cage and suppress the drive,
yeah,
it had to offer a distinct evolutionary advantage to the mosquitoes carrying it.
It offered a massive advantage. And this reveals a really cool interplay between the target gene and mosquito behavior.
Yeah, it's tied to the eyes, right?
Exactly. Remember, the gene drive targets the cardinal gene, knocking out normal eye pigment and replacing it with glowing blue eyes.
Right.
But that 3 base pair insertion in cage A3, it blocked the CRISPR cut, but it did not destroy the function of the cardinal gene itself.
Oh, so those mutant mosquitoes had normal eyes.
Yes. They maintained completely normal functional black eyes. And it turns out, the transgenic AGTP13 males with the glowing blue eyes, they were slightly sluggish.
Ah, so there was a fitness cost.
A minor one, yeah. They were less competitive at swarming and mating than the males with normal vision and no genetic baggage.
So the mutant males with normal eyes just simply outmated the transgenic males.
Exactly. The functional resistance allele aggressively outcompeted the gene drive.
That single failure in cage A3 highlights why scientists absolutely must run multi-replicate trials. I mean, if you only ran cage A1, you would assume the tech is invincible.
Right, you'd think you solved malaria on the first try.
And if you only ran cage A3, you'd assume it's a biological dead end.
It perfectly illustrates the concept of operational risk in genetic engineering. It proves that resistance will emerge if the biological conditions allow it.
So evolution finds a way. But let's talk about the cargo. Did the actual anti-malaria payload stay intact, or did it mutate too?
That was the other massive question.
Because it's basically the biological equivalent of repeatedly photocopying a document, right? Yeah. You copy a copy of a copy millions of times over 2 years, you expect the image to degrade.
That was a severe concern. If you are deploying a synthetic software update into a population, you need to know the code won't just scramble itself.
Did it?
No, the structural stability was actually remarkable. They extracted DNA and RNA at year 1 and year 2 to sequence the payload. The genes encoding the M1C3 and M2A10 antibodies showed 0 structural mutations across all the successful strains.
Wow, 0.
0. They remained perfectly intact, and transcription data proved they were still expressing exactly when triggered by a blood meal.
But there was one structural anomaly, wasn't there? In the ACTT43 strain.
Yeah, good catch. In the strain carrying the larger payload with the antimicrobial peptides, the copying mechanism did slip.
What happened?
Well, the payload in ACTP43 included multiple tandem repeats of a peptide called TP10.
Tandem repeats, meaning identical sequences right next to each other.
Exactly. And when you engineer identical sequences of DNA directly adjacent to one another, you introduce a structural vulnerability.
During cell division.
Right, during meiosis, when homologous chromosomes align. If there are identical repetitive sequences, the chromosomes can misalign.
Oh, I see.
So when they cross over and recombine, one of those repeated sequences can simply drop out. In one of the cages, a single copy of the TP10 sequence was lost due to this natural homologous recombination.
So it wasn't a failure of the CRISPR targeting system at all. It was just a fundamental mechanical quirk of how chromosomes handle repetitive code.
Exactly. And that tells future genetic engineers exactly what to avoid. Do not use tandem repeats when packing your cargo.
Lesson learned. Now, speaking of the CRISPR system, what about the notorious off-target effects? If Cas9 is just floating around the mosquito cells for 2 years, is it randomly slicing up other parts of the genome?
They looked really closely at this. They monitored a highly probable sentinel off-target site, a sequence that closely resembled the intended target.
And what did they find?
Over 2 years and millions of sequencing reads, the mutation rate at that sentinel site was completely indistinguishable from the background mutation rate in wild mosquitoes.
So Cas9 remained strictly on target.
It did. They did log one spontaneous deletion on the X chromosome affecting a gene called scarlet, which also influences eye color.
Was that caused by the drive?
No. Deep molecular sequencing confirmed this was a natural deletion occurring between natural repeat domains in the mosquito's own DNA. The gene drive did not cause it.
Okay, so the drive mechanism is highly efficient. The payload is incredibly stable. The CRISPR enzyme is acting with surgical precision.
It's firing on all cylinders.
But all of this molecular engineering leads to a single, pragmatic endpoint. Does this mosquito actually stop the transmission of malaria?
Right, that's the only thing that really matters.
To prove that, they couldn't just rely on genetic sequencing. At the end of the 2 years, they took these highly engineered mosquitoes and literally fed them blood actively infected with the Plasmodium parasite.
And the parasite challenge assays at the end of the 2 year mark are just, they are the absolute triumph of this research.
How do they set it up?
They exposed the ATTP13 mosquitoes to a low gametocytemia challenge. This is crucial because it mirrors the actual concentration of parasites a mosquito would encounter when biting an infected human in the real world.
Because some lab tests just overwhelm them, right?
Yeah, many lab tests overwhelm mosquitoes with artificially high parasite loads, which doesn't give you accurate field data.
So under these naturalistic conditions, what happened?
The engineered mosquitoes demonstrated an 80.3% reduction in the mean intensity of sporozoites in their salivary glands.
And the sporozoites are the highly motile, infectious stage of the parasite, right?
Yeah.
They are the exact biological bullet that gets injected into a human bloodstream.
Yes. Cutting that load by over 80% is massive.
So what does this all mean for the big picture?
The implication goes even deeper than just an average reduction. In malaria epidemiology, there is a recognized transmission threshold.
What's the magic number?
If a mosquito carries fewer than 10,000 sporozoites in its salivary glands, its ability to successfully infect a human drops exponentially.
Okay, and did the engineered mosquito stay below that?
During this year two test for the ACTP13 strain, under natural infection conditions, zero mosquitoes crossed that 10,000 sporozoite threshold.
Wow, zero.
Zero. The genetic payload didn't just reduce the parasite, it effectively suppressed the mosquito's transmission capability below the critical epidemiological danger line.
So we have 35 generations of dense, continuous data. We have definitive proof of structural stability. We have biological confirmation that the payload severely cripples transmission.
It's an incredible data set.
The inevitable question, though, is whether these findings indicate we are ready to move from lab cages to wild environments. Are we there yet?
Well, this study provides the crucial empirical anchor that mathematical models have been waiting for.
Meaning the 2 year mark.
Yes. Previous epidemiological models calculated that to actually eliminate malaria in a specific region, the genetic modifications must remain highly functional and stable for a minimum of 2 years.
And this hit it.
This is the very first time we have empirical biological proof hitting that exact 2 year stability benchmark. It takes the concept out of theoretical simulation and proves it operates in living breeding populations.
Let's leap from a climate-controlled cage in Irvine, California, to the dense, chaotic ecology of sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, that is immense.
Oh, absolutely.
The study proves the molecular durability, but we have to collaboratively acknowledge the hard boundaries of what a laboratory environment actually represents here.
The rigor of the science demands we recognize the limitations. These were strictly controlled laboratory cages. There were no natural predators, no severe droughts, no fluctuating seasonal temperatures.
And the mosquitoes themselves were long colonized strains, right?
Right. They've been breeding in laboratories for years, meaning they lack the intense, chaotic, and genetic diversity you find in a wild Anopheles population.
And I imagine the same applies to the parasite they used.
Exactly. The Plasmodium falciparum parasite used in the blood meals lacked the vast genetic complexity of wild parasite strains circulating in endemic regions.
So a perfectly controlled environment removes the immense selective pressures that wild ecology exerts.
It does.
But those limitations don't invalidate the benchmark. They provide the exact blueprint for the next phase of engineering. The data shows exactly how resistance forms, like in cage A3. It shows how structural cargo fails when you use tandem repeats.
Precisely. We now know the precise stress tensions of the technology over a 2-year horizon.
So the next logical step is designing next-generation multi-effector drives.
Mm.
Engineers can build payloads that target highly conserved, unmutable essential genes in the mosquito.
Right, drastically reducing the chance of a functional resistance allele emerging in the first place. We can engineer specific molecular redundancies to ensure the overall system holds the line.
So to wrap this up in a couple sentences, this study proves definitively that population-modifying gene drives can maintain their genetic integrity and parasite-blocking power for over 2 years and 35 generations.
It demonstrates that while natural selection will always push back, genetic engineering has reached a level of sophistication robust enough to weather that evolutionary storm.
Which raises a really fascinating and maybe slightly terrifying biological question moving forward. What does this mean for the future of wild ecosystems? If we successfully deploy these flawless gene drives, creating an impermeable wall of engineered antibodies inside the mosquito, what intense evolutionary pressure are we about to place on the Plasmodium falciparum parasite itself?
That is a brilliant point. We are focused entirely on outsmarting the mosquito, but the parasite will inevitably try to mutate past our best molecular defenses.
It's an arms race, and we just handed the mosquito a massive upgrade.
We really did.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Color in the marker glow, proof in the patterns that we stay.